Just a quick warning, this podcast contains a few swear words here and there that may offend some listeners.
So I thought I'd begin this episode with the best news ever. Mum's written back to me. She's really done it. She's actually done it. It arrived this morning. I've been standing by the letterbox every day, to be honest, willing it to come, and now it has. It's just a short letter, but it's a start, a connection. I know Mum's carers were going to sit down with her and help her write it, and yet again, I'm just so grateful to them. So here it goes. Here's what Mum had to say. Dear Catherine Ann, thank you for getting in contact with me after all these years. It was a shock at first, but a lovely shock. It's lovely to hear you had a lovely upbringing with your adopted family. This is a relief for me. I'm so sorry to hear that you had ovarian cancer 2 years ago. It must have been difficult, but I'm happy you are now healthy and happy. A lot's happened in my life, but I'm a lot happier and settled now. I live in a care home in Cambridge. I've heard a lot about COVID, but luckily it's not affected me too much living in the care home. I'm very glad to hear that you've had your COVID vaccination. I've had mine too. Sorry it's been a while before I replied, but I didn't know what to say at first. I hope to hear from you soon. Love from Mum. Kiss. She also sent me an up-to-date photograph of herself, and I'm looking at it right now. She's sitting in a chair with a big cheeky smile on her face. It's like she's grinning right at me. I'm just so happy that she's got back to me. And she used my birth name. She called me Catherine Ann. It made me feel so validated in a way. That's how I'll reply in my next letter. I love the way she talks to me in the letter. It's like we're chatting face to face. And hopefully we will one day soon. I've waited 60 years for this and it feels bloody fantastic. What a day.
We were going to share news of Esther's mum's letter later in this episode, but we just couldn't wait. We wanted you guys to know right away. I mean, you've been with us on this journey. And it really is the best news to end this series on. We both thought that this might be a good point to reflect on what's happened along the way. So I reverted to my day job as an interviewer and sat down to ask Esther a few questions. I'm going to kick off with a biggie. What have you learnt about yourself when you've been making this podcast, Esther?
I don't know, I've learned a lot about patience. I think I've learned that you've got to sit back and just wait for people to get back to you because not everybody's on the same time frame as you. And because of COVID, you know, people are working skeleton staff and stuff, so it takes longer to get back to you. So that was hard. I've also learned just to believe in the human condition again, and also angels. You know, we were talking a lot about angels that come into your life and help you in so many different ways. And I think I've had loads of them in this podcast. And also as well, I've learned that you can do anything if you put your mind to it, anything at all. Don't be afraid to delve and dive in, you know, just go for it.
Are you glad we did it? Do you have any regrets?
No regrets. Well, That's not strictly true. I have one regret. I should have started this a lot sooner. But it's tough. Facing up to all those secrets and lies from my past, it isn't easy. But the most positive thing is dealing with cancer has given me inner strength and the courage to finally do this. To face up to whatever this search might throw at me. I'm so glad we did it because without this podcast, I would have never have found my mum and I'd probably never have found the real me.
What do you think's been the toughest part?
Well, if I'm completely honest, and I think I should be, I think the toughest part has been the effect it's had on our relationship. It's been pretty stressful at times, hasn't it?
It certainly has. You know, I think working together has probably been the most stressful thing I've ever done.
We cope with my cancer better than this, but you know what? We pulled through, and we always do. In the spirit of keeping things real, here's part of one of our phone calls. Gail was happy for me to share it, and it shows the strain we're under. I was having major doubts one day, so I told Gail I was thinking about giving up on the podcast, so I headed off to a cafe. To be fair, in the early days, I gave up on a pretty regular basis. Gail was exhausted with it all, but she called me to try to talk me down.
Come back. Whereabouts in the town are you?
I'm just sitting in a cafe, crying.
It's just so emotional and so stressful and it's not been good for us, has it? I mean...
Not really.
No, it's not at all.
It's not been quite awful, actually.
This is so hard. And, like, it's taken out of both of us. Do you know what I mean? This whole thing of families and secrets and, you know, shame. And, you know, all that. It goes on and on and on. It continues with people. That's all.
It does continue with people, and the consequences of those secrets and lies are, you know, they end up equaling someone that is a person that is unsure about life and where they fit in and struggling to find out where they can fit in, and it can take a lifelong journey. And I just feel that, you know, what with the cancer and all this, all the meeting people in my past and my family and connecting with people, it does join up the dots, but those dots can be also fragmented as well and not join up. And you've got to live with that, and that's really hard. You know, and you just have to find inner acceptance yourself about how you are and what happened, you know, and just think, well, at the end of the day, it's just me. I'm just me. That's all it is. And no one, and not anybody can say any different.
You know, it's good to expose how that happens, you know. And whether it's social work involved, whether it's families, you know, there's collateral damage. And that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Showing that. That there are consequences of secrets and lies.
Yeah. Yeah, there are.
That's all. And still are.
Yeah, and I, you know, I think that is a very powerful message.
Yeah.
I am the consequence of that, you know.
Yeah, and still are.
It can be quite overwhelming at times. Do you understand that?
Yes, I do.
But I will finish it, and I owe it to all the people that have been involved in it to finish it, and to you to finish it. So of course I will finish it.
You owe it to yourself, and you owe it to young people in care. That's who you owe it to. Not the people in it, not me. You owe it to yourself. and all the young people who've had to do that dance through hoops for everybody else. Are you hung up on me again?
I'm still in a cafe crying.
But Gail and I got through it. We always do. Through thick and thin, that's our motto. We love an adventure, and this has been our biggest one yet. There's been tears, and you've just heard some of those. There's been lots of laughter too, though, and shocks.
You're a really well-kept secret.
Am I? Really?
Yeah, I think you're a really well-kept secret.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Mm. Wow.
Finding my mum was more than I ever hoped for when I started making this podcast. It's just incredible. I think it shows that it's never too late, that you should never, ever give up on your dreams. I'm coming to the end of all this now, and I do wonder what's ahead of me. Being in remission from stage 4 cancer. I try not to focus on the future too much. I prefer to live in the moment. It's the best place to be. But I do wonder what's next for me, where this adventure will take me. I'm happy and healthy right now, but inheriting the BRCA1 gene means that I've also got a higher risk of developing breast cancer at some point. I'm receiving counselling for that, and it does help. It's a lot to take in after everything I've been through. This podcast exceeded all my expectations and then some. But if I was being super greedy, I'd say that now I've found my mum, it would just be incredible if I could find my dad. And stranger things have happened, right? So I'm just going to throw it out there to the universe. If anyone knows of a Black American Air Forceman called Bob Hubbard, who served in Scotland, possibly at the Kirknewton camp in 1960, then please contact me. And while I'm at it, I'd also like to give a shout out to anyone who knows the Graham family, who lived in Beath, Ayrshire, Scotland in 1963. Surely Jean can't be the only person in the world that remembers me as little Doreen. Are any of the Graham family out there? If so, I'd love to hear from you. I'm off to write back to Mum now. We're taking things slowly at the moment. I don't want to rush her. But hopefully, when it's safer for me to travel, we can meet up. I'm already dreaming of that day. Just talking to her. Getting to know her. Finding out about her life. But just a few days later, my world was rocked to the core. A phone call changed everything. It was the care home in Cambridge. Mum had suffered a stroke. She was unconscious and receiving palliative care. They didn't know if she had days, weeks, or months left to live. An hour after that call, I was on the train alone to Cambridge. It was a 7-hour journey with a couple of changes, but I knew I had to do it. My gut was telling me to get there as soon as I could. Gail and I had been having a lovely day. We'd gone on a long walk and we were sitting in a local cafe having brunch when I got the news. I just rushed back to the flat, packed a small bag and headed to the station. Gail wanted to come with me, of course, but I knew it was something I had to do on my own. I spent the whole journey just hoping and praying that I'd get there in time. That Mum would be that she'd still be alive. I arrived at about 9:30 in the evening. The care home staff gave me a warm welcome. They told me that Mum had just returned from hospital. She was unresponsive, but they thought there was a chance that she'd know I was there. Then they led me to her room. She was so frail. This tiny little woman struggling to breathe. My mum, I was with my mum at last. The staff checked in from time to time, but basically I was left alone with mum overnight. I sat with her, held her hand, stroked her head, told her stories. I even painted her nails because the staff said she liked that. I told her that I loved her. Told her that it was okay to go because I could see she was struggling. Told her I was so happy that we managed to meet. I'm sure she blinked when I said that. In the morning, I decided it was time to return home. I was exhausted but happy that I'd said hello and probably goodbye to my mum. I left a letter for staff to read to her. It was just telling her how much I loved her and how I'd never stop loving her. Just 4 hours after arriving home, there was another phone call. It was the care home. They were calling to let me know that Mum had died. There's no instruction book on how you should feel when you get news like this. I felt like I was in limbo. I was so confused. I was so alone. And I was angry. This just seems so unfair. I mean, it was bloody cruel. Mum and I had only just found each other after all these years. After all the heartache, we'd finally reconnected, and now this. Now this. The anger didn't last for long, though. I'm not an angry sort of person, really. No, the main feeling was gratitude. That might sound a bit strange, but I just felt blessed that I'd been able to meet Mum. Okay, it wasn't for long, and the circumstances weren't ideal, but I finally managed to meet her, finally got to hold her hand. So many adoptees never get that chance. I was one of the lucky ones. And I think she knew I was there. I think she hung on to meet me. I was the last family member to see her. And I'd let Uncle Eddie know, of course, but he was abroad on business and, well, I don't know what happened with Marie. But it's like it was meant that I was supposed to be there for her in her hour of need, that I was meant to find her. The staff told me that they read my letter over and over to Mum before she died. I hope she heard it. I do have one regret. A little while back, I was talking to one of Mum's carers and she asked if I wanted to talk to Mum. She said she could go and get her and see if she was up for it. But I panicked. I wasn't prepared. I wasn't ready, so I just said no. Said I'd prefer if we arranged a phone call further down the line. Of course, that never happened. And now I can't get that missed chance out of my head. It hurts. But there was no time to dwell on things. There was another trip to Cambridge to organise for Mum's funeral. This time, I wasn't going alone. Gail was coming with me.
Uncle Eddie returned home and organised his sister's funeral. As per her wishes, Anne was to be cremated. Eddie planned to conduct the ceremony himself and Esther was going to give a eulogy. For the second time in 10 days, she was making the long journey south.
Gail and I had a hotel booked in Cambridge. We spent the day before the funeral just looking around the city. It was so beautiful. Mum had been in the care home for years, but she apparently lived in Cambridge for a long time before that. It made me happy somehow to know that she'd stayed in such a gorgeous place. As I wandered around, I kept thinking about her, imagining her walking these same streets. Uncle Eddie drove us to the crematorium. It was great to see him, emotional too. Three of his kids and one of their partners were coming too. The plan was that we'd all have dinner together afterwards. It was strange meeting up under these circumstances, but I was looking forward to connecting with more of the Lindenberg family. There were a few carers and residents from Mum's home there too, but that was it. No one else. It felt very sad. As we waited to go in, the residents shared some funny stories about Mum. They said she was a real joker. Someone who was always smiling and never had a bad word to say about anyone. I liked that a lot. One lady told me that Mum was famous for having two breakfasts every day. Her first two Weetabix were scoffed at around 5 a.m. and she'd follow that up with a couple more later that morning. That made me laugh so much. I'm a big breakfast fan myself. Then the hearse arrived. My spray of all white flowers was on top of the coffin. The card said, "From Baby One." Mum's carers had recently told me that that's what she called me, so it seemed appropriate. I had my speech in my pocket, and I was feeling very nervous, but ready to do it. Then just before we went in, one of the carers came up to me. She told me that Mum had never forgotten about me, that she'd spoken about me a lot, and had always wanted to find me. That anger I had when I first heard the news suddenly came rushing back. I was angry at the lack of mourners, angry at myself for not finding Mum sooner, but most of all, I was angry at what society had done to me and Mum, separated a young Mum and her baby in the name of morality. There'd been so many secrets, so many lies, too much swept under the carpet. It was time to tell the truth. I abandoned my written speech and instead gave one from the heart. And this is roughly what I said. Many of you here don't know who I am. I'm Esther Robertson, Anne Bruce Lindenberg's daughter, and I'm so proud to say that. The reason you haven't seen me around before is that I met Mum for the first time in my adult life 10 days ago. Life's not been particularly kind to her over the years. She's had a hard time of it. Young Anne was a pretty, party-loving, outgoing girl. A great singer, a stylish dresser, and according to my Uncle Eddie, the cleverest member of her family. But being a teenage single mum in the 60s was frowned upon. It wasn't easy for these girls. They were seen to have brought shame on their families. They were sent away to mother and baby homes to have their babies in secret. I was put up for adoption and I've been looking for my mum for most of my adult life. It seems she never ever forgot about me. One of Mum's carers has just told me that Mum talked about me often, said that she loved me, and I always loved her. She always was by my side. I was baby one to her and I always will be. No one can ever, ever take that away, no matter how hard they try. Rest in peace, Mum. It was then, at that exact moment in a crematorium in Cambridge, that I realised that I'd found the real Esther. The one I'd been looking for so long. I'd finally stopped hiding my emotions and learned to speak out. Stop worrying about everyone else's feelings and just say what I thought. It felt incredible, liberating, powerful. And I've got my mum to thank for it. She gave me that power, helped me find my true self. It was her last gift to me, and it's a pretty special one. I've been telling my own story throughout this podcast, but along the way, I hope I've managed to tell some of Mum's too. Managed to explain how difficult it was for her and the thousands of unmarried young mums like her. How lonely and scared they must have been. How society let them down. During the 1950s, 60s and 70s, an estimated 250,000 women were forced to give babies up for adoption in the UK. 60,000 of those were in Scotland. The majority of them were unmarried young girls like my mum. They were offered no help by society and instead shamed and coerced into giving their babies away. Amnesty International have described the practice as an abuse of human rights. The governments of Australia, Canada and Ireland have already apologised to their citizens. Monica Lennon, a Labour MSP, has now called for the Scottish Government to issue their own apology. Gail caught up with her for a chat and she started off by asking Monica why she feels so passionate about this campaign.
So these young women found themselves forced to give up their babies and, you know, frankly, they didn't have a choice in the matter. And it's a real stain in our history that this happened. You know, for decades, people were made to feel that they were dirty, that they had bad morals, that no one would ever love them again. Just so, so sad. And, you know, as someone who doesn't have direct lived experience of that, you know, I've had to listen to people who do tell their stories, and you can't fail to be completely moved and to feel angry, feel this burning anger that this could ever happen. Mm-hmm. The system failed these women and girls and their families, failed these children, and, you know, an apology won't make up for that. It doesn't change the outcomes, but it acknowledges that these young women who found themselves pregnant, they were blameless.
How were the women coerced into giving up their babies?
Certainly there was lots of pressure within the family. You know, young women who were still living at home with parents, you know, found themselves being forced out into the street, you know, sort of threatened with being disowned, and again, their choices narrowed. We have to look at the role of the state and look what happened in terms of social workers, doctors, nurses, people today who we would put our trust in, you know, members of the church, so clergy, priests, nuns, so on. You know, people who you look to for protection and guidance, but really there was so much cruelty. I think there was just a lot of fear put into these women that, you know, no one would ever want to marry them. They would never get an education. They would never, you know, be able to find work, really that their life was over.
In May 2021, you submitted a motion to the Scottish Government for these mothers to be given a formal apology and also provided with some long overdue support. Can you tell me a bit about that?
It just struck me that this was an area that had been given very little attention indeed, and there had been many attempts by survivors and campaigners to get an acknowledgement, to get an apology, and it just looked like nothing was happening. So putting forward the motion for debate was quite straightforward, and it wasn't difficult to get cross-party support. I think everyone you speak to can see that this is a glaring human rights breach. So I used most of the minutes available to me just to read out the words of a survivor and campaigner, Mary McMillan, who just speaks with such clarity about the injustice that happened and why she believes there needs to be that acknowledgement to acknowledge the wrong that was done. So we know that for many of the survivors, that time is running out. Marion herself had a terminal illness and she's a fantastic woman. She's got a great spirit, but she's fighting her own health battles. And I just feel it would just be so wrong, knowing that we know that Marion doesn't live to see that apology. And I know sadly others have sadly passed already and they've not heard those words, "We are sorry." this has been a lifetime of hell for many women. And everyone's experience has been different, so mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to say that everyone has had the same journey to travel, but I think most people that I certainly heard from and have listened to, they talk about the impact on their mental health and just the questions that they've had about their own identity. Families have been ripped apart, and it's just so cruel what's happened. I still remain optimistic that there will be an apology in Scotland, that the state will make that apology, because it is the right thing to do. I just, you know, Women to Women would appeal to our First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, mm-hmm. to use the power available to her to cut through all the bureaucracy that I think has got in the way, all the different barriers, to cut through that fear, because there's still, I think, some organisations that maybe feel they were part of the past and part of the problem. But everyone I speak to, you know, people are not looking to single out individuals or to blame, you know, one Prime Minister or one government of the day or any one institution. It's a recognition that this has been a system failure. People like Esther, who really courageously shared their story and helped people like me who have not had that experience understand what it's been like. And hopefully, by learning from other people's stories, we can all learn to be less judgmental. Lots of other MSPs spoke in that debate with real passion and determination. So again, this is something that cuts across party lines. I also know colleagues in the House of Commons are also very, very committed to this. In particular, my Labour colleague Harriet Harman, who's the mother of the House. So if anyone can try and drive it forward in Westminster, it's Harriet Harman. Again, I just would appeal to parliamentary colleagues, you know, not to get bogged down in process and bureaucracy and just cut through all this and give people the apology that is long overdue and the apology that they deserve.
So that's it. We're coming to the end of this podcast. To be honest, I can't quite believe I've finished it. The old Esther would have walked away halfway through. I probably would have said something like, "Sod this for a game of soldiers," and gone clothes shopping instead. But I'm glad I didn't, though. Making this has been overwhelming at times, but I've learnt so much about myself. After 60 years of searching, I finally found Esther, and you know what? She's not that bad. I actually quite like her. And I found the most important part of me. My birth mum. Can you believe that? Our time together was incredibly short, but I feel so blessed to have met her. All those hopes and dreams I had when I was lying in the cancer ward came true. I did it. And it was like it was always meant to be. Always meant to happen. Looking for Mum has helped me find the real Esther, and in return, I hope I've managed to share her story. And I hope both our stories can leave a legacy, can help others. That would make me really, really happy. This podcast's for anyone who's ever felt like they didn't belong. Whether it's because of the colour of their skin or who their father was or for any other reason. It's for those of you who are searching for your mums. Those of you who've chosen not to search for their mums, and those of you who've had a difficult or fractured relationship with your mums. It's for everyone who's ever felt incredibly lonely. Who's ever thought there was no one like them. Who spent their lives staring in envy at those perfect families. This one's for you. Be yourself. Be proud and never ever give up. And I want to say a big thanks to everyone who's been on this journey with me. All the contributors and everyone who's offered emotional and practical support. You're all bloody amazing, and I couldn't have done it without you. The drinks are definitely on me.
Looking for Esther is a Spotify original series. It's produced by That Old Chestnut Productions in association with The Big Light Studio. Executive producer is Gail Anderson. The series is written and produced by Gail Anderson and Esther Robertson, with additional narration by Janice Forsythe. Executive producer for Spotify is Alex Adey. Music composition, editing and post-production supervision by Brian McAlpine. Executive producer for The Big Light Studio is Fiona White. Esther was one of the winners of the Spotify SoundUp scheme in 2019. To see photographs of Esther and her family, go to Looking for Esther Podcast on Instagram. Contact information for support services mentioned in the podcast is also available here. For additional show notes, go to thebiglight.com. If you're enjoying this podcast, then please rate, review, and share on social media.